I'm Emma Jones.
This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
What matters to Bristol?
Nobody's saying it should be free, Karen.
Okay, but let me finish.
That's not fair, and it's the type of thing that a big company does to try and hoodwink the public.
We ask the questions.
Look, I started at the top of this interview. For the past 5 years, it's been an issue.
But why has it taken 5 years?
First, with the names that count.
We're on the same page, Pat.
Yep.
I totally agree with you. I said earlier on, I don't mind people having a quiet drink and a quiet celebration and saying what they think. I'm not afraid of talking to anybody.
Your stories.
And nearly a third of families looking after children whose parents are unable to care for them are living in severe poverty.
What matters to Bristol?
Yeah, but we don't sexualise it, they sexualise it.
No, but it's our minds. That's what some people might say, isn't it?
It's actually their fault that we're looking at it in that way.
The questions.
Do we disown you? What? You tell me.
But either way, the end result is I either marry Sanjay and lose my family or lose Sanjay and keep my family.
A dilemma.
Someone who loves me, switch the radio on. Someone who loves me.
Wherever you are, BCFM 93.2 are the station you can count on to represent Bristol.
Hi there, this is Pauline Black from The Selector, and you're listening to BCFM on 93.2 on your radio.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours.
Hello, and welcome to Dialect. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2 FM.
Until
you realize you're in it now. Fear is here to stay. Love is here for everything. Call it instant chess. When it's past the legal limit, someone's scratching at the window. I wonder who is a better detective from the deck of you belong to the parents who are ready to hear the rest about their daughter's disappearance. So it really took a miracle to get you to stay. It only took my little fingers to blow you away. Watching the detectives, don't get cute. Just like watching the detectives, get so angry when the teardrops start. Watching the detectives, watching the detectives, watching the detectives.
you're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Okay.
Hello and good evening, this is Duncan Bambridge here, filling in for Tony. Now introducing our first clip from the late Aldous Huxley speaking at a lecture in Berkeley in the 1960s, titled The Ultimate Revolution.
First of all, I'd like to say that the conference at Santa Barbara was not directly concerned with the control of the mind. At Santa Barbara we were talking about technology in general and the effects it's likely to have on society and the problems related to transplanting of technology and technology into underdeveloped countries. Well, now, in regard to this problem of the ultimate revolution, this has been very well summed up by the moderator. In the past, we can say that all revolutions have essentially aimed at changing the environment in order to change the individual. I mean, there's been the political revolution, the economic revolution, in the time of the Reformation, the religious revolution, all these aimed, as I say, not directly at the human being, but at his surroundings, so that by modifying the surroundings, you did achieve, an effect upon the human being. Today, we are faced, I think, with the approach of what may be called the ultimate revolution, the final revolution, where a man can act directly on the mind-body of his fellows. Well, needless to say, some kind of direct action on human mind-bodies has been going on since the beginning of time. But this has generally been of a violent nature. The techniques of terrorism have been known from time immemorial, and people have employed them with more or less ingenuity, sometimes with the utmost crudity, sometimes with a good deal of skill acquired by a process of trial and error, finding out what the best ways of using torture, imprisonment, constraints of various kinds. But as I think it was Metternich said many years ago, you can do everything with bayonets except sit on them. That if you are going to control any population for any length of time, you must have some measure of consent. It's exceedingly difficult to see how pure terrorism can function indefinitely. It can function for a fairly long time, but I think sooner or later you have to bring in an element of persuasion, an element of getting people to consent to what is happening to them. Well, it seems to me that the nature of the ultimate revolution with which we are now faced is precisely this, that we are in process of developing a whole series of techniques which will enable the controlling oligarchy, who have always existed and presumably always will exist, to get people actually to love their servitude. This is, seems to me, the ultimate in malevolent revolution, shall we say. And this is a problem which has interested me for many years, and about which I wrote 30 years ago a fable, The Brave New World, which is essentially the account of a society making use of all the devices at that time available, and some of the devices which I imagined to be possible, making use of them in order to, first of all, to standardize the population, to iron out inconvenient human differences, to create so to say, mass-produced models of human beings arranged in some kind of a scientific caste system. And since then, I have continued to be extremely interested in this problem, And I have noticed, with increasing dismay, that a number of the predictions which were purely fantastic when I made them 30 years ago have come true, or seem in process of coming true, that a number of techniques about which I talked seem to be here already, and that there seems to be a general movement in the direction of this kind of ultimate revolution, this method of control by which people can be made to enjoy a state of affairs which, by any decent standard, they ought not to enjoy. The enjoyment of servitude. Well, this process, as I say, has gone on for over the years, and I become more and more interested in what is happening. And here I would like briefly to compare the parable of Brave New World with another parable which was put forth more recently in George Orwell's book 1984. Orwell wrote his book between 45 and 48, at the time when the Stalinist terror regime was still in full swing, and just after the collapse of the Hitlerian terror regime. And his book, which I admire greatly, it's a book of very great talent and extraordinary ingenuity, shows, is so to say, a projection into the future of the immediate past, of what for him was the immediate past, and the immediate present. It was a projection into the future of a society where control was exercised wholly by terrorism, and the violent attacks upon the mind-body of individuals. Whereas my own book, which was written in 1932, when there was only a mild dictatorship in the form of Mussolini in existence, was not overshadowed by the idea of terrorism, and I was therefore free in a way which Orwell was not free, to think about these other methods of control, these non-violent methods. And I'm inclined to think that the scientific dictatorships of the future, and I think there are going to be scientific dictatorships in many parts of the world, will be probably a good deal nearer to the Brave New World pattern than to the 1984 pattern. They will be a good deal nearer, not because of any humanitarian qualms in the scientific dictators, but simply because the Brave New World pattern is probably a good deal more efficient than the other. That if you can get people to consent to the state of affairs in which they are living, the state of servitude, the state of being, having their differences ironed out and being made amenable to mass production methods on the social level, if you can do this, then you are likely to have a much more stable, a much more lasting society, a much more easily controllable society than you would if you were relying wholly on clubs and firing squads and concentration camps. So that my own feeling is that the 1984 picture was tinged, of course, by the immediate past and the present in which Orwell was living, but that the past and present of those years does not represent, I feel, the likely trend of what is going to happen. Needless to say, we shall never get rid of terrorism. This will always find its way to the surface. But I think that insofar as dictators become more and more scientific, more and more concerned with a technically perfectly running society, they will be more and more interested in the kind of techniques which I imagined and described from existing realities in Brave New World. So that It seems to me then that this ultimate revolution is really not very far away, that we already a number of the techniques for bringing about this kind of control are here, and it remains to be seen when and where and by whom they will first be applied in any large scale. And first, let me talk about a little bit about the improvement even in the techniques of terrorism. I think there have been improvements. Pavlov, after all, made some extremely profound observations, both on animals and on human beings. And he found, among other things, that conditioning techniques applied to animals or humans in a state either of psychological or physical stress sank in, so to say, very deeply into the mind-body of the creature, and were extremely difficult to get rid of, that they seem to be embedded more deeply than other forms of conditioning. And this, of course, this fact, I think, was discovered empirically in the past. People did make use of many of these techniques. But the difference between the old empirical intuitive methods and our own methods is the difference between a sort of hit-and-miss craftsman's point of view and the genuinely scientific point of view. I mean, I think there is a real difference between ourselves and, say, the inquisitors of the 16th century. We know much more precisely what we are doing than they knew, and we can extend, because of our theoretical knowledge, we can extend what we are doing over a wider area with a greater assurance of producing something which really works. In this context, I would like to mention the extremely interesting chapters in Dr. William Sargent's Battle for the Mind, where he points out how intuitively some of the great religious teachers, leaders of the past, hit on the Pavlovian method. He speaks specifically of Wesley's method of producing conversions, which were essentially based upon a technique of heightening psychological stress to the limit by talking about hellfire, and so making people extremely vulnerable to suggestion, and then suddenly releasing this stress by offering hopes of heaven. And this is a very interesting chapter of showing how completely, on purely intuitive and empirical grounds, a skilled natural psychologist, as Wesley was, could discover these Pavlovian methods. Well, as I say, we now know the reason why these techniques worked, and there is no doubt at all that we can, if we want to, carry them much further than was possible in the past. And of course, in the recent history of brainwashing, both as applied to prisoners of war and to the lower personnel within the Communist Party in China, we see that the Pavlovian methods have been applied systematically and with extraordinary efficacy.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Yeah. largest intelligence apparatus in the world, with the biggest budget in the history of the world, has been looking for Osama bin Laden for years and years and years, and can't find him. Some doofus jerk-off reporter with a camera crew waltzes right into his hideout and interviews him. So why do all these fools believe this charade? That a CNN reporter and his little camera crew can do what all the money and all the assets and all the eavesdropping and all the intelligence and all the satellites and all the undercover operatives in the world can never do. It's because they're not trying, they don't want to. Osama bin Laden is their creation, and he is serving them well. I mean, is this some kind of incredible joke that people are so stupid they'll fall for this? And now we're being bombarded with messages that Osama bin Laden is planning to attack the United States of America and Israel. Let me tell you something. If he's an enemy of Israel and the Mossad can't find him, then this thing is the biggest joke that you ever heard of in your life. And I'm telling you, be prepared for a major attack. But it won't be Osama bin Laden. It will be those behind the New World Order who once again want to take the guns and the freedom away from the American people, because we're the only ones left in the world who can oppose the destruction of freedom in the world and then the implementation of a one-world totalitarian government, and that is the goal. And whatever is going to happen that they're going to blame on Osama bin Laden, don't you even believe it. To change the minds and the attitudes and the beliefs of the people of the world, and especially the United States, to bring about one-world totalitarian government. I wonder what Osama bin Laden's targets are supposed to be. And if this doesn't materialize in the next 2 or 3 weeks, it will eventually materialize, because they haven't succeeded in getting the guns out of the hands of the American people, nor have they succeeded in taking our freedoms away. In fact, there's been a great awakening in this country and a big backlash against these Marxist, communist, puke-faced, lying, subversive, Nazi, jackbooted Gestapo thugs that is gaining momentum. And so I can tell you with a certainty, they must do something terrible in order to stop this backlash and regain the sympathy of the mass herds of sheeple out there. And supposedly, we're not the only nation searching for Osama bin Laden. So the vast economic resources, the vast technological resources, the vast personnel resources, the vast networks and intricate web spun over all these years by the CIA, the FBI, and the NSA can't find Osama bin Laden, but CNN can.
That was Bill Cooper speaking just before 9/11. RIP. God bless.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Now moving on to something a little more current, an interview with the owner and manager of the Stop NATO website and international mailing list, talking about the recent upheaval in Ukraine and the international gangsterism that has been cultivated by the West.
A couple things we should keep in mind. This is the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War I, the war to end all wars, the war to make the world safe for democracy. It is also the 75th anniversary of the beginning of World War II, with Hitler's invasion of Poland and the deaths of 50 million people. We have to put these matters into perspective. 5 years ago, on the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, which of course was a great media event in the West because it was an orgy of triumphalism, but all Western democratic values had progressed, it dominated the world. A Russian commentator said, the Berlin Wall may have been dismantled, it's simply been erected again along the entire Western border of Russia, and that in fact is the case. And it's another anniversary this year. It's the 10th anniversary of the largest expansion of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in its history. Seven new members were brought in, all of them in Eastern Europe, three of them former Soviet republics, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Immediately upon those three Baltic states being brought into NATO, NATO began a series of regular air patrols with warplanes out of Lithuania. This has been going on for a decade. A Russian commentator, a political figure, mentioned at the time that these planes are a five-minute flight from the second largest city in Russia, St. Petersburg, and not a tremendously longer flight from the capital of Russia, Moscow. I can only imagine if another country were to station warplanes within striking distance of New York and Washington, D.C., what the reaction would be in the American media as well as amongst the American government. But this is what's been steadily mounting, inexorably mounting. President Obama remarked on the occasion of receiving his Nobel Peace Prize yet, identified the United States as, in his words, the world's sole military superpower. That term should send chills down your back. That anything like that could exist at all, much less that the person who identifies himself, and incidentally in that same speech as the commander-in-chief of that world's sole military superpower, boast of it, you know, should have been a wake-up call to the world. 15 years ago, three things happened simultaneously. The first ever NATO summit was held in the first NATO summit ever to be held in the United States occurred in Washington, D.C. To celebrate the 50th anniversary of a military bloc that was created ostensibly to defend itself against the Soviet Union, which at that time had not existed for 8 years. It also marked the first absorption of former Warsaw Pact countries into the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Poland. Yet also, NATO now, not having to worry about a Soviet Union or any other military power that could defend itself, launched a blistering 78-day unprovoked air war against a sovereign nation, Yugoslavia. You know, when I see fascist thugs running through the capital city of a European country, it's evocative of seeing a European capital, Belgrade, in flames being bombed for the first time since Hitler's Blitzkrieg wars. This is what we're talking about. There is no way of exaggerating the severity of what we're facing right now. Now, in the interim, NATO continued to expand. It has now absorbed 12 countries in a decade from 1999 to 2009. That is an increase by 75%. This, again, if you read its charter, supposedly existed to maintain peace in Europe and so forth, right? To the Soviet Empire. I mention that term because it's very much in the news now. I'm sure I'm not the only one in this room who in recent weeks has seen comments in mainstream U.S. corporate media, such as the Russian Red Army has moved into Crimea, into the Soviet Republic of Crimea. This is true. They are either trying to evoke Cold War nightmarish images, or they're intentionally distorting this, or they have not grown out of their own Cold War mindset to any degree so they can still use outdated terminology like that. A couple of things. The USS Donald Cook guided missile destroyer coming into the Black Sea. That's not just any warship. It's, by the way, the third guided missile warship from the United States to go into the Black Sea since the crisis in the Ukraine. There is a convention in 1936 called the Montreux Convention that expressly prohibits warships of a certain size or larger to go into the Black Sea or to stay there over a limited period of time. The U.S. is in clear violation of that convention, and the Russian political figures have notified them of that. But what the USS Donald Cook is what in military terminology is called an Arleigh Burke class guided missile destroyer. It is part of the U.S. NATO interceptor missile system in Europe, what's euphemistically referred to as the European phase adaptive approach. That is, it is the fulcrum upon which the U.S. is erecting a global international interceptor missile system that will make Russia, China, and Iran incapable of retaliating should the U.S. strike them with a strategic strike first. Plain and simple. And I'm sure in military command in Moscow, they interpret the placing of U.S. guided missile destroyers near their border, Russia borders the Black Sea, in exactly those terms. We also have to keep in mind, and this we have to do a lot of unnecessary work and waste a lot of time refuting lies instead of talking about what's actually going on. But let's keep in mind, the U.S. has expanded the amount, they've taken over the rotation of the Baltic air patrols, I remarked. Up until recently, it was 4 warplanes from each NATO country. U.S. is now going to have 12. Britain's going to send 4. France is going to send 4. You're going to have 20, 30 or more warplanes right near Russia's northwest border. The U.S. is now sending 18 F-16s to Poland. The U.S. acquired, after the 2004 expansion of NATO, 4 new military bases in Bulgaria, 4 new military bases in Romania. That is 8 bases, several of them on 3 major air bases that have been used for the wars against Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya, and are poised now to intervene in any military conflict with Russia. Look, the bases have been secured decades ago through NATO expansion. The military hardware, including interceptor missiles in the Polish city of Mirag, Patriot Advanced Capability 3 interceptor missiles, 35 miles from Russian territory, the exclave of Kaliningrad. This has been built up long in advance of the Ukrainian crisis. The Ukrainian crisis is simply the pretext for the U.S. and its NATO allies moving more military equipment up to the Russian border, not simply to contain it. There's no need to contain Russia. It is to besiege Russia. And there's only one reason you besiege a country, either to starve it out or to attack it. And nothing less severe is at stake right now, and that's why it is so demonstrably important that we organize against this rhetoric that, you know, in many ways is even worse than the depths of the Cold War, as I remember. But I've had occasion to mention a couple people here today. This evokes memories not so much of previous crises we can think of in the last 40 or 50 years. This is almost something tantamount to what it felt like during the Cuban Missile Crisis, if anyone can remember it. It's the most serious potential for a direct military confrontation between the world's 2 major nuclear powers, and one that was gratuitously and recklessly initiated by the United States in the manner that it was described, where Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs Victoria Nuland was caught on tape, she doesn't deny it, in addition to, pardon the expletive, but F the EU, talks about exactly who's going to come into control after they've overthrown the government in Ukraine, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, you saw him, and that's indeed, I mean, they're following orders. She ordered the coup, she ordered who is going to control the junta in Kiev, and now the U.S. is moving, and incidentally, military exercises around Lviv in northwestern Ukraine, the nationalist headquarters, be coming up in 2 months. It's called Rapid Trident 2014. U.S. and other NATO allies are going to be there. Almost every year for the last 10 years, U.S. and NATO have led naval military exercises in Crimea. I suppose this year they won't, called Sea Breeze. There have been, and one last thing I want to say, because I think this is very, very important. The conflict in Ukraine was triggered, it was planned. And it was triggered on November 21st of last year when then president, by the way, whatever we think of him, legally elected, internationally elected, head of state of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, announced not that he was not going to sign an association agreement with the European Union, but that he was deferring the signing of that. I cannot believe. I mean, I've been to Kiev, I've met Ukrainians, I believe they're as politically sophisticated as anyone else in the world, but I cannot for a moment believe that because an obscure agreement that I'm sure 9 out of 10 Ukrainians never even heard discussed was being postponed, that people went out by the tens of thousands in the streets of Kiev, set the city on fire, murdered 14 police officers, sent 86 of them to the hospital, brandishing swastikas and variations thereof, and overthrow a government. I can't believe they did that based on the association agreement with the European Union. But anyone who's looked at that association agreement, there's a very strong military component to it. It suggests the further integration of Ukraine into Western military structures, including European Union battle groups. And for anyone who still sustains the illusion that there's a major difference between European Union foreign policy and NATO foreign policy, there is none. They are united under a program in the 1990s called the Berlin Plus Agreement that integrated the militaries. Just a few weeks ago, a British general, Richard Sharif, retired as second major military commander of NATO, Deputy Supreme Allied Commander Europe. He was simultaneously the commander of Operation Atalanta, which is a European Union naval operation in the Arabian Sea and the Indian Ocean, which complements NATO's Operation Ocean Shield. These roles in the militaries are interchangeable, they're coterminous. So what we're looking at here is that, and the last thing I think we have to remember, presidential elections were scheduled in the Ukraine for a year ago last month. If things were so intolerable, right, if the oligarchs, who are a nasty bit of business, no question about it, on either side of the aisle, if the oligarchs or Yanukovych or whomever somebody opposed, you know, was such a big problem, what would we be told here to do? To organize an opposition candidate and vote him out of office. You know, if anyone here who is defending what happened in the Ukraine, Mr. McCain and Mr. Murphy and Newland and company, were to advocate that we replicate the Ukrainian model here in the United States, where incidentally, I'm sure Obama's ratings are lower than Yanukovych's were when he was overthrown. If anyone was to advocate that we replicate the Ukrainian model in Washington, they would be taken out in handcuffs and subjected to trial for treason. This is what, you know, we've allowed, you know, what people have allowed themselves to tolerate. The NATO needs to be disbanded. We screamed that in the streets of Chicago 2 years ago. I think this gives us, if I could summarize it this way, this is a culmination of the 15 years of NATO expansion, and this, I fear, is the final act of U.S. plans to contain and ultimately attack the only country in the world that has a strategic military force capable of defending itself against the United States. I think that's what the geopolitical background of this crisis is, and I think it's urgent beyond belief. The American people don't want war with Russia. They certainly don't want to be nuclear incinerated. And what we need to do is to demand the cessation of American intervention in Ukraine and all other countries, given our track record. And whether that's political subversion or outright military aggression, as in the case, there's a great banner there about Ukraine, Venezuela, and Syria linking the three. There's no question in my mind these three are coordinated, and the offensives against the governments in all three countries were not only simultaneously, but I think related. At any rate, I applaud everyone's efforts in building an anti-war movement. It has never been more necessary than it is right now.
And you can find out more information from blogger and activist Rick Rozoff at rickrozoff with a K, rozoff.wordpress.com.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. It is on BCFM 93.2 at 11 a.m. on Mondays. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. That's dialectradio, one word. Or you can download this and many other podcasts from radioforall.net. That's radio4all.net. Or you can listen online at bcfmradio.com/dialect. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Cooperative production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to contact us, you can through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. Thanks for listening. So until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 12, four executives at Tesco have been suspended after the supermarket giant admitted it overstated its profits guidance by £250 million. Shares in Britain's biggest grocery chain dived to their lowest level in 11 years in early trading as the revelation triggered its third profits warning in as many months. Labour will keep the cap on child benefit for 2 years if it wins the next general election. It's part of a range of measures Shadow Chancellor Ed Balls will announce in a speech at the party conference this lunchtime. He says Labour's always been committed to helping families, but the country needs to save money.
I want to do everything I can to do more to tackle child poverty, help vulnerable parents, to make work pay, but we're going to have to make difficult decisions to get the deficit down. So in the first 2 years, for child benefit, which goes to very many people, we'll keep the 1% cap.
The Met Police investigation into the disappearance of Alice Gross is under scrutiny after it was revealed officers waited 4 days before formally requesting the Latvian police file on prime suspect Arnis Zalkans. The 14-year-old went missing on the 28th of August in West London, a week before the builder was last seen in Ealing. More than a third of victims of hate crimes actually know the people abusing them. Researchers from the University of Leicester say the results of their research were a huge shock, as most people assume the offenders are strangers. Dr. Neil Chakraborty is behind the study.
Sometimes offenders were so-called friends, family members, carers. So that, I think, obviously has a devastating emotional impact upon you, but it makes it quite challenging to report.
Police are investigating racist abuse targeted at Liverpool striker Mario Balotelli on Twitter. The Italian tweeted, "Man United, LOL, short for laugh out loud," after the team suffered a surprise 5-3 Premier League defeat to Leicester. A NASA robotic spacecraft has ended a 10-month journey to put itself into orbit around Mars. It will eventually look for the red planet's lost water. That's the